We live in this sort of uncertain world. You never know what the future is going to hold for sure. So you have to make bets about the future that are based on a model. The real key to being a successful person in life is not how smart are you day one. It's how much better can I get? How much can I improve myself? And you improve yourself through learning and then consolidating that learning in order to make, hopefully, a better decision the next time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast of The Decision Lab, a socially conscious applied research firm that uses behavioral science to improve outcomes for all of society. My name is Brooke Strzok, Research Director at TDL, and I'll be your host for the discussion. My guest today is Roger Martin, former dean of the Rotman School of Business at the University of Toronto and author of over a dozen best-selling business books, as well as longtime strategy advisor to global brands such as Procter & Gamble, Lego, and Ford. Roger has joined me on the show once before to discuss a previous book, Creating Great Choices. But in today's episode, we'll be talking about his latest book, A New Way to Think, in which Roger walks us through some very prominent mental models in the business world, how we generally react when those models cease to serve us well, and some options for replacing them. Roger, thanks for joining us once again.
It's great to be back, Brooke.
Let's dive in. The latest book is about mental models and how they're used by executives. But what is a mental model? Let's just get some alignment on that before we go any further.
It's a way of thinking about something about the world. You create a model that helps you make a decision. So you might have a model that says the best thing to do when you walk up to somebody for the first time is extend your hand to shake their hands in greetings. That's a mental model that says, rather than randomly kind of think about what one might do when one meets somebody else, you've got this model. So that's probably a good way to start. And basically, we have models for everything we do in life. So they're a huge part of our world.
So there are a certain representation of stuff that we see out there, and they include a lot of if-then rules that help you to figure out what to do in various situations.
Yeah, exactly. Like if meeting a new person, extend hand to shake. That's an if-then rule. And the model holds that is a friendly way that would be perceived as friendly by somebody else. And I want to start out in a friendly way. So it's got a bunch of if-thens embedded in it.
And in your consulting work, and this is really the impetus for the book, you've noticed a certain pattern of what happens when mental models break down in the world of work and, you know, executives working with mental models. When we're confronted with the shortcomings of these models, when we extend our hand and someone doesn't respond the way that we expect them to, how do executives usually respond?
The usual response is to say, I didn't use the model well enough. So maybe I wasn't smiling while I extended my hand. Maybe I extended it quickly and too aggressively. So I should do it in a slightly different way. But the model of that's the right thing to do remains unchanged.
And does that lead us anywhere productive, or does it get us stuck in ruts?
It can lead in a productive direction if indeed you sort of did a crummy job of utilizing the model. You were really curt and abrupt, or you had a frown on your face. It may help you say, oh, no, it's important to do it in a friendly way. However, it sometimes simply doubles down on something that isn't working. In some parts of the world, extending your hand to shake it is insulting. In that part of the world, if you keep saying, well, I got to do it nicer, I got to smile, you will just get yourself deeper and deeper into trouble. And that's the phenomenon that I see, which is when something isn't working, a model in use is not producing the results it purports to or is intended to. They just keep trying it more. That is not good for anybody.
That's really the impetus for the book, is these situations that you've seen where the mental model itself is not delivering the results promised. And so people just burrow in and keep pushing harder and harder and harder on the model. And so the book itself explores over a dozen prominent models in business. In each of the chapters, you identify some of the serious challenges to that model and offer an alternative that seems to fare better in response to that specific set of challenges. I don't want to use this conversation just to rehearse what you've already written in the book. I loved the book, and I strongly encourage readers to listen to it. I'd like to come back to your real purpose in the book, which is to help executives to think through what to do when models are breaking down. And in that vein, I propose that we dive in with some tactical advice. So how can an executive identify when the model is breaking down because it isn't being applied rigorously enough, as opposed to the model itself no longer being sufficient to the task at hand?
I think the most important thing to do is to be really clear on what would be a signal that the model is working. If you've got sort of a vague model that says, oh, you know, well, we should pursue shareholder value maximization, and you don't say, here's what I expect to see, So I expect to see that executives will behave in this fashion and produce this kind of results, and that will result in shareholder value maximization. If it's a vague notion, then lots of things can go on, end up not getting you to what you want, where you say, well, I don't know if that had to do with the model. What that will give you a better chance of doing is auditing what has happened. Let's just use shareholder value max. We want our executives to maximize shareholder value. And for that reason, we're going to give them lots of stock-based compensation. So if they get the shareholder value to go up, they'll make lots. So they'll be properly incented to take steps that are always in the interest of that. If you then observe executives doing things that are inconsistent with that, sort of going to Wall Street and hyping the stock, then watching the stock fall, then go back up and you say, well, they seem to be promoting volatility, not going in the right direction, then you could say, well, the model presumed that they would engage in these behaviors. They're not engaging in these other behaviors. Then you can have a chance of reverse engineering that and saying, well, what could possibly be causing that? Then you go to the forks in your road to say, well, what could be causing that? We didn't give enough stock-based compensation, or it wasn't of the right form. And you can at least test that and say, well, it's because we gave them all options and we should give them deferred stock units. And then we'll see this instead. So you're once again doing the if-then so that you can audit it again and say, well, they're still doing what they were doing before. Then I think you have a better chance of saying that something about this model is completely flawed and is not producing what we wanted. Now it's time to revisit the model.
I want to dig into some of the behavioral angles there. So there's one aspect here, which is about being very explicit and concrete as opposed to somewhat vague and nebulous. Why is vague not good enough?
Because it'll be hard to audit afterwards to figure out whether your cause and effect model works, the if-then model. You have to know the if and the then, or it's going to be hard. Human beings, unfortunately, have an almost infinite capacity to ex post rationalize. So they can say, if we do this investment, our sales will grow at 10% a year for 5 years. And the 5 years, sales have grown at 7%. The mind has an uncanny ability to say, yeah, seven, unless you were explicit and wrote it down and said, I am making this investment because if we build that factory, we will have the capacity to grow our sales at 10%. And you write it down and you put it in the drawer, and 5 years later, you pull it out, and then you can compare the 10 to the seven that you've said and said, well, something, it wasn't a disaster, but something about my model for what would get you 10% sales and increase was simply kind of not on, was not working properly. You're trying to guard against ex post rationalization.
It's that confirmation bias that we will find a way to make the whole story cohere nicely.
Absolutely. All the behavioral biases absolutely play into this. That's why I recommend to everybody, when they make a decision, to write down why they made that decision. Just write it down. It's because I think this, I think this, I think this, and I think this. Because only then can you learn so that you can go back. So if something doesn't work the way you want and you didn't write it down, all you have is it didn't work. If instead you wrote it down and said, well, I thought customers were going to do this, and I thought competitors were going to do this, and the regulators were going to do this, and then you can look back and say, oh, the competitors did this other thing. So the rest of my logic was actually pretty good, but what did I not see about competitors in the face of this? So that next time you build a model that says, we're going to do this, you'll have a more sophisticated understanding of the competitors. If you didn't write all of that down, you'll just say, well, that was a bust. Of course, I don't want to have another bust, but I don't really have any good ideas how, what was flawed about it other than it was wrong. Then it's sort of devastating, right? I was wrong and it didn't work well. And what do you have to show for it? Got nothing. Nothing. Yeah. You want to have something useful to show for your mistakes or failures.
There's kind of a two-tiered shortcoming here if you don't write it down. The first is that you're much more likely to find a nice coherent story to tell yourself that in fact it wasn't the failure that you're trying to avoid staring in the face. And the second is that even if you do manage to stare it in the face and say, well, you know, we didn't actually reach the outcomes that we'd hoped, if you haven't written it down, you haven't put yourself in a position to actually learn from that shortcoming, to identify what went wrong and to be able to do better the next time.
Absolutely. And again, we live in this sort of uncertain world. You never know what the future is going to hold for sure. So you have to make bets about the future that are based on a model. The real key to being a successful person in life is not how smart are you day one. It's how much better can I get? How much can I improve myself? And you improve yourself through learning and then consolidating that learning in order to make, hopefully, a better decision the next time.
Speaking of better decisions the next time, once we start to recognize that the models are not holding true to the world in the way that we'd hoped, how can we go about identifying or crafting a new model that's better suited to the challenge? So before tossing it back to you, I'll pull one of the examples that you mentioned previously where you said, okay, well, we're expecting customers to behave this way and we're expecting input prices to behave this way and we're expecting competitors to behave this way. You notice that competitors are starting to behave differently than you had anticipated. And that's, in this instance, let's say, a very, very crucial assumption for your model. And so now you say, well, we need to move towards something new. We need to craft a new model that better reflects the facts that are becoming clear about the world. How do we go about doing that? Identifying what the key determinants are in this situation that we know our model needs to solve for.
It's a tricky question because it is a creative act. I mean, the creation of a way of understanding the world is a creative act. It's advancing the state of knowledge in the world. So it's no small feat. What I would do if the rest of my model seemed to hold, it was just the competitors, I would attempt to understand more. I'd study that competitor more and say, okay, they did something other than we thought. What is it about them that we could imagine they do other things in a similar way? Ah, now we can understand it's competitors in general, or it's that competitor we didn't understand. So I'd focus on that to be able to come up with a coherent explanation of why what happened actually happened rather than the thing we expected. And that would be my new model for testing. My presumptive model, I'd say, okay, if this is important, let's go off and do a test to see whether that competitor will behave in a way that's consistent with this new model. It's mainly just trying to reflect on what they did and explain it. You've got to explain what's already happened. In what way would a sensible competitor choose that versus what we thought they would choose?
Explaining the previous failure is an important starting point because that's a key input into redefining the problem space that you find yourself in. So the failure of the old model, when we keep kind of butting our heads against the wall, what we're doing is essentially trying to apply a model to a problem space that it doesn't fit anymore. And so explaining the previous failure is valuable because it helps us to update our view on what the problem space is in which we actually find ourselves.
The economists call Bayesian updating.
Yeah, I can't help but make a comment at this point about the views of humanities and lots of different fields out there, and to remark that Bayes himself was a minister in some far-flung parish who had a hobby. Statistics was just his hobby on the side. So this idea that actually inspiration and really powerful innovation can come from very unexpected places is an example that Bayes himself proves very well.
Yes, no, it's a good story. Same with patent clerks. They can also make a difference in history.
Have there been some famous ones of those?
Yeah. Like Albert Einstein.
Okay, so we start to update our views on the problem space. And as you articulated, based on updated understanding, then we start to piece together some new if-then rules. And then, of course, the next thing to do is go out and start testing them because, you know, ultimately, the model is a hypothesis. It's something that we aren't sure about. It's an educated guess. It's not a stab in the dark, but there's still always going to be some uncertainty and there are going to be some assumptions that need to be validated before we have confidence to go out and start applying this new model. What are some of the barriers or challenges that executives will face in trying to get a new model defined within the organization? So when the old model stops working, we've just been talking about kind of the operational process for how to update that and build or identify a new model. But there's also beyond the operational, a bit of a kind of small p politics involved of the dynamics of getting the organization to go along through this conversation.
To me, to a certain extent, there's a bit of a growth mindset, Carol Dweck kind of angle to this, right? If the executive in question has great stake in demonstrating that he or she is right more of the time than not, they may be more inclined to say, well, I can either double down on this model and force us to try it again. Maybe then it'll work and I don't have to admit I was wrong on this. If they have more of a, if you will, a growth mindset rather than a fixed mindset, they would probably be inclined to say, hey, as a leader, my job is to keep getting better. And the way to keep getting better is to enhance my models and telling my organization that this model that we tried didn't work is not some giant defeat. It's just a stepping stone in getting a better model. This has a lot to do with the mindset of the person deploying the model. the mindset that I try to encourage people to take is the great John Sturman of MIT says, you know, all models are wrong. They're an abstraction on life. So they aren't life, they're an abstraction. So they're all going to be found wanting in some way. It's only a question of how useful the model is. And then when we find it failing to be as useful as we wish, how can you modify it? You want to have that mindset rather than thinking their job is to be perfect, because that's an impossible job.
Yeah. And in terms of that mindset, I mean, my sense is that a growth mindset is something that it's hard to propagate in a vacuum. If you find yourself surrounded by people who are trying to be perfect or trying to signal perfect very strongly within their organization, someone with a growth mindset will be swimming against the current. Another thing that came to mind as you were speaking is the parallel between a growth mindset and things like strong public health institutions and trust in government and these kinds of things. They're the types of things that you want to already have developed as assets at the moment when you need to reach for them. The moment that your model breaks down and you're in crisis is a difficult moment to say, well, now we should start adopting a growth mindset.
No, that's true. And there are sort of downward and upward spirals of this too. So if you're projecting everything about a fixed mindset, which is you're making promises, you know, they may be somewhat implicit or they may be very explicit to say, you know, you've appointed me, hired me, elected me because I'm right, then the stakes are higher when you're wrong. You might well be inclined to say, oh my God, since I've told them I'm right on this, and now I'm going to have to admit I'm wrong, I'll be crushed. But it's only because you promised it, right? If instead you say, I always learn, I always get better, there will be missteps. And all I can promise you is that when there are missteps, I'm going to do a better job the next time. I'll take into whatever we've learned and be better and better and better. If that was your election promise, if you want to talk about politicians, then it's just no big deal to say, hey, this thing we did didn't work out so hot. We've analyzed it a lot and we were missing. And so here's what we're going to try now that's built on that. Everybody will say, yeah, of course, that's what he or she told us they were going to operate like. So no biggie. I tend to think that people create traps for themselves. In many respects, it's like that metaphor of the person walking into a jail cell, locking himself in, throwing the key outside, and then going on the bars, get me out of here, get me out of here. It's like that was you who locked yourself into that cell. I see a lot of that going on, which is sad. I mean, we shouldn't joke. It is sad when people trap themselves into a situation that they loathe and what I try to help executives do is create a world around them where it's an upward spiral of learning rather than a downward spiral of defensiveness.
It strikes me that one of the key pieces in that is going to be around those if-then rules. You know, we want to make a prediction about what we expect to happen on the basis of certain assumptions holding in this kind of thing. And there is, to use a distinctly Canadian idiom, there's deft bit of stick handling that needs to be done to say, we will make this projection, but the projection is not a promise. How does one weave that into there to put forward that projection and be clear about what it is that we expect without so strongly tying themselves to it that if that expectation is not achieved, then somehow that reflects on them as a failure?
Well, I think it's to socialize the if-thens. It's a chapter on strategy in the book on what would have to be true is such an important question. So what would have to be true is sort of a categorization of the if-then statements. You say, well, what would have to be true for this strategy that we're considering pursuing being a good idea versus what would have to be true for this other strategy to be a good idea? I believe that it's much better to socialize those. It is a chief executive with a senior management team to have all the senior management team say, yeah, we agree. These things would have to be true for A to be a good idea. Now let's as a management team say, which of those A or B do we think is more likely to be true? And so we're going to B. We like the looks of B better and the assumptions we're making on that. And so the team as a whole says, that's what we're going to do. And then you have the what would have to be true diagram so that after the fact, if B doesn't work out the way you wished, it's not the chief executive alone doing it. It was the management team as a whole doing it. And they can tell, we miss thinking about what that competitor would do. So again, they're not shattered as a team. They understand they had it almost right, but not quite. And how can they improve it? But if you keep those what would have to be trues to yourself as your secret, then it's going to be harder for other people to see the magnitude of the error. Maybe was not all that gigantic. It wasn't that it was a stupid idea on its face. It wasn't that it was not thought through at all. It was thought through and 7 assumptions were made. One of them didn't work out. Okay, that will help you feel better about what's happened rather than despondent, shocked, dazed by what happened.
It's also more actionable because you've identified what you need to correct for in the next model.
Absolutely.
As you were talking about that, it started to become clear in my head that there are really two perspectives to take on this. There's the defensive model perspective, which is like, what are the barriers that I'm going to face in bringing together my executive group and getting them to share the risk? That's the kind of defensive posture perspective on this. The challenge, or, you know, seen from another direction in this more growth mindset posture, is how am I going to convene the discussion? How am I going to manage the dynamics of the discussion to make sure that everyone's input actually gets heard in articulating, first of all, fleshing out what are the assumptions that are baked into our model, and also making sure that any insights or intelligence that any of those individuals has sitting around the table actually gets aired at that critical moment. If we've got 12 people sitting around the table and one of them knows with a very high degree of certainty that one of our key assumptions is false, and that person doesn't speak up, that is an enormous loss of important resource there. You're investing time, you're investing money to learn something that somebody at the table already knew.
I agree. I couldn't agree more. And that's why I think of strategy as a team sport. Yes, you can have someone who's got a bunch of brilliant insights, but even if they do, it doesn't mean they have all the necessary brilliant insights. They may have a set of brilliant insights that comes up with possibilities that maybe nobody else would have thought of, but then there might be somebody else who's got a perspective on that now that it's been put out there that is absolutely critical to it. I think the best strategies come when a group comes together and the diversity of the group is embraced, not discouraged. Because you could have that, as you pointed out, you could have that person in the room with a diverse perspective that they never share because they think they're going to be shot down for having shared something that other people wish they wouldn't be saying, making sure that you get those on the table. And that's why I say in these processes, it turns out that it is much harder to get agreement on what is true than what would have to be true. Because what would have to be true is logic. What is true is the combination of logic, if-thens, and data. And I like to separate those two things out to say, what's the logic structure? And then let's ask, how would we apply data to that logic structure to the extent we can? If you just say what would have to be true, what I find is that diverse voice is more likely to say, well, I think this would have to be true for it. That person may be saying, I don't think that thing is true to him or herself, but you're not asking for that now. You're just asking them to help you figure out the things that would have to be true that we're going to have to get comfortable with in order to make that choice.
So in terms of the barriers that one might face in trying to convene this kind of conversation internally, the first challenge is to shift the conversation dynamics from what is true to what would have to be true, and to shift that perspective, which is maybe the bigger shift, from everyone in the room trying to figure out what it is that they can commit to because they're sure it's right, versus trying to figure out where their greatest dependencies are and where the biggest assumptions are that then need to go out and be tested. That's barrier number one, is kind of shifting the conversational dynamics. And then barrier number two is, once you've set the agenda for that meeting effectively, so to speak, how do you conduct the conversation in such a way to be able to get those perspectives coming out so that people actually do challenge each other and saying, well, I'm not sure that that's actually as essential to picture that's emerging here as you say that it is. What if X and Y and Z, these things could all be true and we could still have a problem, or this thing could turn out to be false and we shouldn't worry a whit about it, and these kinds of things.
I think the key in how to conduct meetings like that is to find a way to incorporate everyone's perspective in some way. So sometimes the answer is, you're thinking about a different possibility. Let's focus on this one that we're working on now, and then we're going to come back to yours and say, let's reverse engineer, say what would have to be true about that other possibility. Or if somebody says the following would have to be true, but I'm sure it's not true, then you just say, well, let's wait. Other people think it may well be true. How could we test that in a way that both people would be compelled by the answer?
One of the questions that we address is what would have to be true. And that's articulating these if-then statements. But then you mentioned, of course, testing is the next part that comes along there. Slightly different question, which is, what would it look like for that to be true? How would we recognize it? What would be a valid test of this? How can we follow along in this team sport of strategy to create essentially testing criteria for the things that we've just articulated.
One thing I do is turn over test design and standards of proof to the most skeptical person in the room, right? Which some people said to say, really? You know, aren't they just going to try and submarine the possibility that they don't like? And I say, you know, no. If you want everybody to put their hands on their heart at the end and say, we all feel committed enough to try this, the most skeptical person is the person who's going to have the hardest time putting their hand on their heart. So let's help them by putting them in charge of testing. While it's theoretically possible, right, that person would create a test that's so high that you could never pass it so that they eliminate it. I've been doing this for many years, this approach to strategy for, well, I guess it's 30 years, and I've yet to see that happen. And when I haven't seen something happen in 30 years of doing it, I start to think the empirics say that theoretical problem is not manifest. And you might ask why. And my theory, and I'd be interested in yours, Brooke, because you, from your work, you may have additional better theories. It's one, people tend to be obstreperous to the extent that they aren't listened to. Terrorists are often terrorists because they don't feel their voices heard. So they do extreme things, justifying their, it's quite possible that the voice should have never been heard in the first place, but that's what drives them to do it. So if you instead say, no, we're not only listening to you, we are actually putting the keys in your hands, then they become, I think, hypersensible. And then the other thing is there's a mutual assured destruction aspect to that, right? If you design a test that's impossible to pass on possibility you don't like, somebody else is going to do the same to the possibility you like. So the social behavior I've seen is being hyper responsible. But what it does, it has a drag along effect. So if the most skeptical person ends up feeling good about it, everybody else is likely to. So you don't get this sense of at the end when the choice needs to be made, somebody saying, yeah, but I still just don't buy it. Thanks a lot, buddy, but that doesn't help anyone.
One of the things that I've noticed is that the people who are often the most skeptical are more fiery in their rhetoric than they are in the actual practice. If you can force them to be concrete, what they're asking for concretely is often much less intense than it would appear just based on the kind of intensity of their discourse.
I would agree. They want to be heard is the number one reason. If they feel strongly about something and they're not heard on it, is sort of doubly upsetting.
And when they are heard, what they actually are asking for seems, in some sense, shockingly not that high a bar. The longer they go on being not heard, the higher the bar will feel like it is. But once you actually concretize the thing and say, okay, sure, so I understand you have misgivings about this. What would you have to see? And then being as exploratory and concrete in that instance as you are in trying to articulate the if-then rules, it tends to come to a place that's actually quite reasonable. And not even in the long run, you have to wait until the data's in and these kinds of things to realize it was reasonable in retrospect. Actually, in the moment when you sit down and articulate it and concretize it, it comes off as much more reasonable than things seemed.
I agree with that. And the other thing I've noticed, and I'd be curious if you noticed this too, they also tend to be good at designing the test because it's something that really kind of matters to them. And they say, I'd have to see customers who I think are going to say this other thing, whereas somebody else might not be as good at designing the test because they're not quite as clear on exactly what's at stake and what matters. That person tends to have thought about it a lot and be good. And designing ways of testing propositions is a real skill. It's an important thing that I think is often sort of undervalued. It's doing the analysis once the test is designed is lauded. Wow, he or she is a real analytical wizard. They were doing the R squares till the cows came home. As opposed to, no, it was actually that tricky creative part was designing a kind of a test that could work.
Yeah, there are two things that come to mind in response to that. The first is that an old friend of mine who's a statistician said, I know when research groups are in trouble because they have to call in a statistician. And the other is that, as you were mentioning, you know, there definitely is kind of persona or archetype of the person who is so used to being that challenger, so used to being that skeptic, that they've spent an inordinate amount of time going out and doing the data collection because the conversation dynamics haven't been in a place where just bringing a little bit of evidence was already enough to kind of raise the flag, like, oh, maybe there's something interesting going on here. Maybe we should dig further into that. They needed to be putting up massive placards about, you know, how intense the risks are. So they've needed to deliver the big guns over and over and over again. And of course, in the process of doing that, they've become quite good at it.
That's very interesting.
Let's think about practical steps. So let's envision there is some executive are sitting listening to this and saying, oh my gosh, this is just describing exactly what's happening around me in my organization. What can they start doing tomorrow morning to, for instance, just get conversations started around which of the mental models that we're using right now are not serving us well?
First, just think about things that have been disappointing. And I think any executive could very quickly say, we tried this thinking we were going to get this and this other thing happened. We raised wages by 10% and thought that people would, you know, feel all cheery, and the quit rate didn't decline at all. So just go to that and say, write down as best we can recall, what was our model? What did we believe? It was like, well, people are motivated by money, and if we give them more of it, they'll be motivated to stay. Okay, got that. Let's now try and come up with other explanations for why that didn't happen. And that might involve going and talking to half a dozen people who you were stunned and amazed that they resigned after the salary increase was put into place. You ask them, get some data to be able to come up with at least a couple of theories that could sensibly explain what you've already seen. Out of those theories, you'll come up with one that's worth testing that is a better theory than the theory that you had.
Maybe we can offer some more specific criteria for what kinds of frustrations. So one where you're very disappointed and maybe surprised or a bit blindsided by the outcome that you saw. Perhaps going back to the very, very beginning of the conversation where we talked about doubling down on models and using the amount of effort that's being put into trying to apply the model better and better as a bit of a cue as well. We're investing a lot of effort in trying to improve our implementation of this. But even as we improve, or even as we invest resources in implementation, we're not seeing the needle move, or we're not seeing it move nearly enough to kind of satisfy us that we're moving in the right direction.
Absolutely. Results that are in the direction that we thought, but not nearly as far, would be one kind. Ones that would be in the opposite direction would be another kind. We thought it would be happy, they're sad. And then maybe ones that are orthogonal, like this, you know, something happened that just that was not more of what we thought, was not the opposite of what we thought, was just something different happened. I think you could put them into those categories. I think one thing that should always be on the table is, did we actually do what the model said? Sometimes you look back on it and say, well, we didn't actually do it. We thought we did what the model would have said are the steps that we should have taken, but we look back and we didn't do it. We thought we had implemented a 10%, you know, kind of salary increase across the board, but we actually didn't. It was 10% of the people at head office or 10% for people in these functions. And so we didn't actually do what we said. And then you can explore, like, typically it's somebody thought it was not such a good idea and just refused to, you know, threw a proverbial wrench in the machinery.
Yeah. So that helps us to identify those early cases of, like, what should we be focusing on? And then that kind of gets the whole machine running of articulating what are the assumptions that need to be true in order for this to work the way that we think it is, and so on and so forth, as we've just been discussing. Let's talk about those lucky few who managed to scale the mountain. And there they stand, proud atop the peak, having planted the flag. This worked. We built a new model. Everything's rosy and cheery, right? Like, we built the new model and now the new model's here to stay. How do we avoid that trap of saying, you know, okay, great, now we have grown and therefore we don't need our growth mindset anymore?
There's two things that I would say. One is that I'd be trying to inculcate in that person the notion, the sort of John Sturman notion, all models are wrong. They're abstractions. You will find better model is what you should always be looking for. So to maintain the growth mindset. But the other thing that I recommend for people is to put the what would have to be truths about that model. I'd say stick them up in your tack board in front of your desk, and every morning come to work and ask, are the things that would have to be true still true? Many models, as you would know, are temporal. Given this set of circumstances that's now in the situation, this model is a really good fit. It's fit for the environment. But then if the environment changes, there's a new competitor, new set of regulations, customers changing their interests and behaviors, the model can break down. If you got the what would have to be trues, what I say is look at your list of what would have to be trues and ask the question based on your most recent observation, are those things still true? If so, I'd say put your head back down and keep working. But if you notice, the distribution channel that we thought would be really enthusiastic about this is actually just taking some of our shelf space and give it this new entrant that's doing something other than us. What we thought was true about our distribution channel ain't looking so true anymore. Does that mean the model crumbles entirely? Could we tweak it to make up for that? You can start making that decision. That is the canary in the coal mine.
Yeah.
What would have to be true list is the canary in the coal mine that'll give you an early warning that even though the model may be seems to still be doing okay, it's probably going to fall off a cliff in the future.
I'll just say one short thing on that front and say that's the approach that I've always advocated for building dashboards. These data dashboards that are constantly updated and these kinds of things, I've seen so many instances where those are so driven by what data is available rather than by what's important to pay attention to, that we've got these massive dashboards full of, you know, dials and lights and all kinds of things, but only one or two of them are really essential for decision making. Three or four things that are essential for decision making are not there.
I agree. I mean, I more often think of the dashboards that I've seen as being things that the creator of the dashboard loved, not the user of the dashboard. Lots of dashboards aren't actually used. Somebody had an idea of what would be a cool dashboard rather than a dashboard that would be highly employed.
Roger, that wraps up the questions that I had for you today. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the book before we sign off?
Sure. It's coming out on May 3rd. You can pre-order it on Amazon and everywhere else already. And what I hope is, not unlike Playing to Win, Creating Good Choices, it's a manual. It's a practical manual for helping you make decisions that you will enjoy the results of more. This one is slightly different in that there's 14 chapters that don't necessarily, they're on the same theme, but don't leap one from another. So you can read it one chapter at a time as a situation on M&A comes up. You can read the M&A chapter on capital allocation comes up. You can read the capital allocation, talent, et cetera. So it has a slightly different feel than my prior books, but I hope it's sort of a manual that people will put on their shelves and refer to.
Well, I count myself among the lucky few who got an advanced copy, and it's already on my shelf with a pride of place. So thank you very much, and thanks for taking some time to talk with us today.
Not at all. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Decision Corner. For a transcript of this conversation and for other related content, head on over to our website, thedecisionlab.com. While you're there, you can also sign up to our newsletter and learn about our consulting services. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and we'll see you back here soon.